Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening, welcome to another Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Mark Linus. Mark Linus is an author and an environmental activist who focuses on climate change. He is a visiting research associate at Oxford University's School of Geography and the Environment. In 2009, he was appointed advisor on climate change to the President of the Maldives, which aims to be the first carbon neutral country on Earth by 2020. Mark is the author of The God Species, How the Planet Can Survive the Age of Humans, published by Fourth Estate in July of this year. He has previously written two major books on climate change, High Tide, News from a Warming World, and 6 Degrees, Our Future on a Hotter Planet.
So I've been joined by Mark Linus. Mark, thanks for speaking to Little Atoms today.
It's my pleasure.
We're going to be talking about your book, The God Species, so first of all we should talk about that title. What does it mean?
Well, obviously, one can only use God in this secular age as a metaphor, but I think it's an important metaphor because it sums up, if we are to be, as Homo sapiens, the God species, it sums up our divine responsibility and our power, our sort of omnipresent power. And I think that latter point is most important because the planet has been completely transformed by human activities. I mean, that's almost a truism, but when you think about the depth of that transformation, you know, we've changed the chemistry of the oceans, the color of the skies, the composition of the atmosphere, and of course the entire character of the planetary surface has been changed by humans. So we really are holding the levers of control over the operations of the Earth system, even in a scientific sense. And so that's why we're the God species, because we have to take responsibility for that. And we have to manage the planet intelligently.
So, I mean, you mentioned it is a truism, and it's probably an obvious question, but what is it particularly about us that makes us have more of an impact on the planet than other species?
Well, I mean, humans are an unprecedented evolutionary success story, and it's an interesting question, actually, to figure out why that is, and why it's us rather than, I don't know, dolphins or dinosaurs or something. I mean, dinosaurs were around for a lot longer than us, but certainly they didn't have anything like the power and the capacity that we have in terms of dominating the planet. So, I mean, I think what makes humans special, obviously, it's the intelligence and the brain size and so on, but really, I think it's to do with communication, and it's to do with the ability to pass down knowledge and to compound knowledge down the generations so that, you know, tools that we use in an everyday sense are the product of tens of thousands of human generations of experience in tool making and technology. And, you know, it really is unprecedented. No other species can do that. You know, other crows can use sticks and things, and monkeys can also use tools, but they don't learn in the same way, and they certainly don't learn in an intergenerational compounded way like humans do.
I was taken by the image in the book, the sort of classification of us as the fire ape, and this idea that we're the only species that's been able to utilise sort of an external energy source.
Yes, I think that is crucial. Humans tamed fire probably 1.5 million years ago, probably when it was Homo erectus even, and Neanderthals had fire, and of course, anatomically modern humans, Homo sapiens, also had fire from the beginning. And that probably is what, in an ecological sense, set us apart from other species, because the ability to cook food meant that we could have much more concentrated calories, because of some, you know, fire basically begins the digestion process for using external energy, so you don't have to do that in the gut. So humans have less in terms of jaw muscles and less in terms of gut and more in terms of brain, basically. And fire, of course, gave us the ability, unwittingly, to transform ecosystems through burning large areas. And you could see that right up into the modern era, you know, where with slash and burn agriculture, also with what was called fire stick farming. The Australian Aborigines did that, as did the American Indians. So it's something which has characterized all human societies, and it's unimaginable, really. Humans can't exist without fire in any kind of meaningful sense. And, of course, that then led into the fossil fuel age, because our ability to use external calories rather than just through food like other species do enable us to make use of these enormous reserves of buried calorific energy in the form of fossil fuels.
So the book is based around the idea of planetary boundaries, and you talk of each chapter is based around a different planetary boundary. So let's talk about what this concept actually means. And you talk about a group that you came across called the Planetary Boundaries Expert Group. So who are they, first of all?
Well, that's my name, not theirs. I mean, it's a group in the sense that it's a bunch of co-authors to a scientific paper, which was published in Nature in September 2009. The lead author is Professor Johan Rockström, who's a very well-known Swedish environmental scientist. And the concept that he and his colleagues came up with was that if we are to be stewards of the Earth system, in essence, what are the physical limits to our impact on the planetary biosphere? You know, what are the key elements that we need to be aware of if we're not to push the Earth beyond the boundaries of what is physically tolerable? You know, what needs to be the limit to greenhouse gas accumulation in the atmosphere? What needs to be the limit to the acidification of the ocean? And how many of these boundaries are there, of course? Now, they had a long meetings about this and came up with 9. And so that's the starting point for the book. And most importantly, they quantified the boundaries. So they put numbers on them. They said, right, for CO2 in the atmosphere, it should be 350 parts per million. For the depletion of stratospheric ozone, it should be, I think it's 280 Dobson units, you know, and we're slightly beyond that now because we've managed to partially fix the ozone hole. So it's, I think the power of numbers is a really important factor in this.
So let's have a closer look at some of those boundaries. We probably won't be able to touch on all 9 of them. But first of all, the biodiversity boundary. There's been many mass extinctions throughout the history of the planet. We're now in the midst of the latest one. But how do we know, what are the sort of indicators that make us know that we're actually responsible for this?
Well, I mean, the depletion of species has gone hand in hand with human success, essentially. As we've dominated more and more of the planetary surface and captured more and more of the planetary energy flows, other species have had less and less. So, you know, you can go back and see how early humans, in fact, destroyed the habitats and probably hunted to extinction things like the mammoths, all of the very large animals that started off in the Holocene and disappeared within the last 1,000 years or so. And you can trace this process happening as the Polynesians spread to New Zealand, for example, and obviously Australia earlier on. All of the big animals died out within a couple of centuries of that happening. So it was a very rapid, this early stages of the mass extinction. And it's still ongoing, of course, because we've now got, nearly 7 billion humans. There's less and less space available for other species and more and more competition. So even though there aren't so many species which are going extinct year to year, there's less and less abundance of wild animals. And it's life which makes the planet resilient, if you like. This is the planet is in a Gaian sense. It is a living entity. And so the diversity of life is absolutely important, which makes it one of the, probably the top-level planetary boundary.
I was particularly taken by a quite haunting image of this idea of ghost ecosystems, of sort of plants that have gradually evolved to sort of protect themselves or to be fertilised by the megafauna species that have now subsequently disappeared.
Yes, I mean, there's various examples of this. I think in Madagascar there's certain plants which have thorns at a high level to protect themselves from being grazed by elephant birds, which no longer exist, of course. And there's a lot of megafaunal fruit tree species in South America, which previously had their seeds dispersed by sort of elephant-like, very large animals, which have also been driven to extinction. So, how these trees can exist when they're, when their co-evolved animals have already disappeared, it isn't a very positive scenario. So that's why these are ghost ecosystems. And in fact, there's talk in North America about rewilding and bringing back camels and lions and the disappeared carnivores and very large herbivores, which would earlier on have characterized these ecosystems.
In terms of the planetary boundaries idea, you mention a suggested level of yearly extinctions. Let's talk a little bit about that and where we actually are in reality.
Well, I mean, it's a difficult one to quantify because we don't know how many species there are. We don't know how many species are going extinct. But at a sort of ballpark guesstimate, The proposal for the planetary boundary was that not more than one species per million should go extinct per year. And the best estimates are that the level of extinctions is at least 2 orders of magnitude higher than that. So 1,000 species per million maybe per year are going extinct. So we've got to do a huge, huge amount to address that, to get on the safe side of that particular planetary boundary of biodiversity.
So let's move on to the climate change boundary. And you've already mentioned that there's a current ideal number of 350 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. Tell us briefly how we came to that number.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, this is absolute CO2. The boundary was in actual fact crossed in 1988 when, so that was the same year that James Hansen from NASA first made the presentation to Congress saying that global warming existed, and he was pretty definitively sure of it. Now, we know beyond really the shadow of a scientific doubt that CO2 is the essential thermostat for the climatic system, so it determines the temperature of the planet. There's a lot of stuff going on as well as that, but that's the basic pattern. And to keep the planet stable in a temperature sense, and to keep the temperature at a sort of rough 14-15 average, which it is at the moment, we need to get CO2 back down to the safe level of 350 parts per million. It's interesting, actually, there's a campaign group called 350.org, which is really flowering in the US and other places, which aims to do just this. So it's quite interesting because it's got a scientific and a sort of political and a campaigning viewpoint as well.
The book has caused some controversy amongst the sort of orthodox green movement in the proposal of adopting various technologies to tackle climate change, but also this idea that one of the sort of, the fundamentals of the green movement is the idea that we need to sort of thoroughly change the economic system and modes of consumption of the world. So tell us about why you've changed your mind on that.
I felt that the green movement has to make its peace with capitalism, essentially, and that having environmental concerns as a kind of proxy war for the sort of big left-wing struggle against capitalism wasn't going to work, and it wasn't going to serve the environment well. Now, I can't claim that that's a normative, subjective thing to do with my reading of politics. It's not that I can't claim the majesty of science for backing that. That's different from some of the issues like GM and nuclear, which I do think the Greens are out of step with science on. So there's a different level to this, essentially. I'm calling for a sort of a more realistic politics, essentially, but one which is focused on some quite radical objectives, and achieving the boundaries and staying within them is a very radical ecological idea, but I think that's certainly what my reading of the science points towards.
You mentioned your own sort of experience, the sort of practical experience of being an advisor to the government of the Maldives. So tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, I mean, it's sort of like all the most interesting things in one's life happened rather by accident, in that I had a meeting with the vice president of the Maldives, and out of that meeting and future encounters, the idea came out for the Maldives to be the world's first carbon neutral country, and I was asked to sort of stick around and be the advisor to the president on climate change and try and sort of push that process, and also to help them within the international climate change negotiations. And the thing is, all of that experience sort of pushed me away from being a sort of polemical writer towards trying to have a bit more of a practical bent, because transforming a whole country's energy system is an engineering job, really. There isn't so much you can do by writing about it in newspapers and what have you. So that forced me into a much more pragmatic perspective, right? You know, what are we going to do? Are we going to get rid of diesel, which is generating electricity in the Maldives, and replace it with solar and wind? You know, how are we going to do this? What's the economics going to be? You know, where do we raise funds, et cetera, et cetera? Very practical stuff to do with running a country. And I think that just forced a kind of, mental shift in me, really, which I was trying to take the same perspective for other issues, on a planetary scale, and move away from the luxury of just criticizing all the time towards trying to be more constructive.
So let's look at a couple of the techno solutions, and I was struck by this idea of a European-wide super grid for electricity. So tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I think that's the only way to make renewables work, actually, is to have a much more integrated, a much higher capacity super grid across continental Europe and further afield, because, the great problem, the great Achilles heel of renewables is that if it's windy in one area and sunny in another, those energy sources can disappear pretty quickly. And you can be, certainly in the UK, you can have the coldest periods of the winter are very calm, very still, so you don't get any wind energy and you don't get any solar power. So your two big renewables sources aren't there at the coldest part of the winter when you need the most electricity. And so that makes it expensive to deploy renewables, because you've got to have a complete backup, of 100 gigawatts or something to run the entire country without any renewables. So you're basically doubling your capital investment in energy production. So the only way to get away from that is to be able to import and export power at times of surplus and need. So That means you have to have big sort of pipes to exchange electrical electrical charge between countries. Now, these already exist, of course. I mean, Germany and France import and export, and Germany and the Czech Republic and so on. But we need to upgrade the capacity of that and potentially also import solar power from North Africa. And the Germans are very enthusiastic about ways to get some solar thermal, big, large-scale solar thermal power under the Mediterranean and into continental Europe.
You're listening to Little Atoms this week with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Mark Linus about his book, The God Species. The other obvious big technical fix that you've already mentioned a couple of times would be the widespread adoption of nuclear power. And again, this is obviously something that's extremely controversial in the sort of orthodox green movement. You mentioned in the book about how you'd been influenced by the work of Stuart Brand, and indeed we interviewed Stuart Brand on the show last year, and were similarly taken by his arguments. So let's talk particularly about you mentioned the IFR, the integrated fast reactors. So let's talk about what they are.
Well, I think people tend to, certainly Greens, tend to think of nuclear as a kind of monolithic technology which they're against. In actual fact, there's hundreds of different designs for fission reactors, burning uranium or even thorium these days. And one of the ideas which really struck me was to go back to one of the fast reactor designs which was abandoned in the 1990s, partly under pressure from campaigners, pressure in the Clinton administration. And fast reactors can actually burn up almost all the energy in the uranium which is mined, as opposed to the current reactors which are used, which use very little, and most of it gets thrown out the other end as waste. So what really intrigued me about the IFR was, as a fourth generation solution, it could use depleted uranium, uranium-238, of which there's vast quantities lying around, also burn up plutonium, and also burn up the most long-lived stuff in nuclear waste, which means that you have to have these very expensive geological repositories. So what you'd end up with in terms of high-level waste at the end would be stuff which is radioactive for a few hundred years. So we're not talking about the tens of thousands of years type timescale. So it would substantially deal with the waste problem, and you wouldn't have to have any more mining, and you could probably have two or three centuries, actually, of carbon-free power on a very large scale with existing resources. So, for me, it struck me as a very environmental proposal.
So jumping forward in the book quite a bit to the section on the toxics boundary, which is mainly concerned with the introduction of plastics and chemicals like DDT and stuff into the environment. But you also talk about this idea that, ironically, one of the areas of massive concern is the idea of toxics from nuclear power that doesn't necessarily have to be as bad as we've always thought. And you look at the example of Chernobyl, and you've actually been there yourself. So let's talk a little bit about what's actually subsequently happened around Chernobyl.
In terms of the toxics boundary, radiological pollution is ubiquitous in the environment, from nuclear weapons testing, and also from the widespread use of civil nuclear power, plus the accidents in Chernobyl and now Fukushima. So there's a lot of man-made radiation out there, but it's pretty minuscule compared to the natural radiation which we're all subjected to on a daily basis. So it's probably a hundredth of what was there already. If you don't count the medical x-rays and CT scans and things that we also do because we believe them to be beneficial, which in fact they are. So that's the background to this. When you talk about Chernobyl, there's this sort of very pervasive myth that there's been huge numbers of child deformities, Chernobyl children's charities exist and so on. And people think of it as something which has killed, I don't know, tens of hundreds of thousands of people. Greenpeace, I think, claims death toll of 60,000 or something like that. Actually, when you look at this as a sort of scientific consensus, as we try to do with climate change, the current death toll is less than 50. That's what the best science tells us. The eventual death toll, if you believe the models that the radiological experts use, is going to be somewhere between 4 and 9,000 people, which we will never know, to be honest, because that's a fairly small statistic in a population of many tens of millions, within which, between 30 and 40% of people die of cancer anyway from all of the variety of different causes. So it's a very complex statistical area, this, but the basic bottom line conclusion is that radiation and nuclear power are a lot safer than the majority of people suppose, and that's obviously important for climate change purposes, because it is the largest scale source of zero carbon power, and one which has been pretty environmentally benign in a whole host of other areas. There's big concerns with wind power in this country and elsewhere in terms of bird kills and landscape impacts and so on and so forth, whereas with nuclear you can generate enormous quantities of centralized power on a fairly small land footprint.
Okay, I want to move on to another one of the boundaries. This is the nitrogen boundary. Throughout human history, the amount of nitrogen in the soil has obviously limited the extent to which we could grow food and therefore has limited the sort of rise of population. Then, of course, in the late 20th century, there was the Green Revolution and sort of invention of artificial fertilisers, and that obviously changed massively. But now we're sort of heading to the point, or in fact, I think you mentioned this is one of the boundaries that we've already crossed, where we're actually putting too much nitrogen into the soil. So, first of all, we should talk about perhaps why that's a problem.
Well, it's interesting actually that the Malthusians who felt that human population would be limited by starvation had their real flowering at the end of the 19th century when the world was running out of nitrogen fertilizers. There was guano that was scraped off a few islands in the off the South American coast, and nitrates from the desert in Chile, and not a lot else. And you know, if you apply that to a modern context, it's a bit like the whole peak oil debate, where we're running out of this and it's going to be a huge civilizational crash and so on. In actual fact, what happened was that this problem was solved in the laboratory through the technical ingenuity of two German chemists called Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch, and they invented the Haber-Bosch process, which allowed the production of nitrogen, reactive nitrogen, so ammonia and fertilizers, from unreactive nitrogen, which is the N2 in the atmosphere that we all breathe. So that was an enormous milestone, probably the most important technical innovation of the entire 20th century. At least half of us, probably more, owe our lives to that technical innovation because it enables the very large production, large-scale production of food. So that's been an unmitigated good for humanity, but there are downsides, of course, in terms of nitrogen runoff, dead zones in the oceans, eutrophication. So it's also a driver of biodiversity loss. And we're a long way over the proposed planetary boundary there. So this is probably the most difficult one to solve, even looking at it technically, because you know we can't stop producing food, you do absolutely need nitrogen fertilizers.
Again, you look at a technological fix to at least attempt to sort of ameliorate this problem, and one of those would be genetically modified crops that can sort of fix nitrogen themselves. And of course, GM crops are another big no-no as far as the Green Movement is concerned. And indeed, back in the past, you've taken part in anti-GM actions yourself. So let's talk a little bit about why you changed your mind on this one.
Well, I mean, opposition to GM really has no scientific basis. It's a bit like homeopathy. And, people feel very strongly about it, but it's pretty much an urban myth, so far as I can tell. And I speak from experience, having been an anti-GM activist in the past, and been forced gradually by challenge from people to look at what my motivations were and whether there was any basis in science, and there really wasn't. And you know, I think Europe's left itself out of potentially a very important technology now, looking at biotechnology, which is really one of the main drivers of increasing productivity agriculturally. So there are dangers, there are opportunity costs to sort of staying in the laggards camp of not doing anything because you're scared of new technologies.
Why do you think there is such ideological opposition to this, though? I mean, as yourself, you've experienced it yourself, so...
It's partly to do with fear of novelty and the power of new technologies, the power that this gives humans to play God, to design and invent new organisms. That's true, that power is there, and we do need to learn to control it. And I think it's partly also this fear of big corporations taking over the food chain, this kind of thing. But it's interesting why this doesn't apply to other areas. I mean, no one worries that big corporations make their mobile phones or make their cars or anything else. So it's something peculiar to food, I think, which has a very deep-seated meaning. Obviously, we all need to eat, more importantly than anything else. But, I mean, it has a very deep-seated cultural meaning to people. And so the whole idea of Frankenstein food and something scary happening and, you know, was very appealing to the kind of conservative element, not just of the Green Movement, but of the population generally. And so took off, and it was a real, you know, it was about the most successful scaremongering campaign that's ever been mounted. And as I say, I was involved, and I look back at this now, and I feel responsible for trying to right some of that damage, because there are opportunities for increasing productivity and benefiting the environment, which are not being taken because we've ruled ourselves out of the GM technology potential.
We're running out of time, but I want to sort of talk a little bit about the future, whether you're optimistic for the future. In the last chapter of the book, you talk about being present at the Copenhagen summit recently and how that was a massive failure. So perhaps we should just briefly talk about what happened there.
Well, yes, I mean, I made I had the sort of bizarre experience of being in the room in the heads of state meeting with President Obama and Gordon Brown and 20 or so heads of state at Copenhagen, and I watched why and how the process failed at that point. So it's weird that I've stayed optimistic, but I think we do need to push hard for a legally binding treaty on climate change, because that's really the only way humanity is going to get to grips with this. And the same really goes for the other environmental boundary areas, that we have to deal with this as a species. We have to take responsibility and do that internationally. One country operating on its own really makes no sense. So we do need to be optimistic, and to remember that whilst it's important that we act locally, it's more important that we act globally, because these are global scale problems and we have to deal with them as a collective, and that is perhaps humanity's greatest challenge.
So I've been talking to Mark Lynas about his book, The God Species, which is out now from Fourth Estate. Mark, thank you very much for speaking to Little Atoms today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.